Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
We have a special guest going to join us later in the show, Anthony Giglio.
The shows with Anthony's are always fun.
He's great. He's going to join us from his home in Jersey City, New Jersey. He is the wine columnist for Boston Magazine. He's also rewritten the Mr. Boston Guide, which is the Mr. Boston Guide was behind every bar when I started bartending 15 mm-hmm. years ago, and the recipes were all wrong and bad. And Anthony has redone it, and it just with this edition, and you got to get the one that's edited by Anthony Giglio. Great book, great cocktails, well done, great frame of reference. And he's going to join us a little bit later, but first I wanted to start talking about something that I saw in the news that I thought it was really very interesting.
It really is an interesting little article, and why don't we enlighten our listeners?
It seems as though some European and Japanese cement manufacturers have started using animal renderings as kiln fuel, saving fossil fuel costs while disposing of banned material. The practice could soon come to North America. Disposing of ruminant meat and bone meal has been an environmental problem since the mid-90s when its use as animal feed was banned in Europe following outbreaks of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which is the mad cow disease. Now, that's really interesting. It turns out that here's the problem. Here's what Europe has done that we haven't done, even though the government officials will lie and sort of insinuate that we have.
Do you have an opinion about this, Francis?
Lying, scum-sucking people will lie and pretend like we're not feeding animal material protein to animals, but we are.
Well, one of the things that this article refers to, again, and I just want to reiterate, we feed beef parts to our chicken. Then we scrape up the chicken remains and feed it back to our
chicken
beef.
Chicken litter.
Chicken litter, yes. That's what I mean. And then we feed that to our beef, and somehow that's okay.
And we also, people use, blood, cow blood, as milk mm-hmm. replacers to wean calves off their mother so we can get
them. We're not totally trying to gross you out. We're just trying to tell you what's going on.
Anyway, but that was a practice that happened in Europe and the United mm-hmm. States. They found a couple of cases of mad cow disease in Europe. They were a little slow to respond, not as slow as we are, and they banned the feeding of animal protein, ruminant protein, to ruminants, cows, mm-hmm. because cows are supposed to be vegetarians.
They shouldn't eat cow.
Then you don't make them cannibals, countables. Anyway,
oh.
So what you have a problem is, you know, when you butcher a cow, 50% of the weight of that cow is not good for food. We don't eat, you know, hoofs, you know, bones, you know, whatever.
The
skin,
spinal
teeth,
cord,
whatever.
Right.
So that's a problem now that has to be taken care of.
Right,
now,
you
have
to deal with that.
If you have a mad cow, and that's a lot of waste, and the reason that was turned back into animal feed was because that's a cheap way to get rid of it and mm-hmm. actually make money on something that would cost you money.
Right.
Well,
so the Europeans and what they've done here, they actually have a backlog of 400,000 tons of this waste material.
Carcasses.
Carcasses and bones and things. And so they've decided to come up with a good use for this.
And what they found is this stuff can burn. It has a high carbonic value. And so they use it to fire the cement industry, which requires 2,700 degree heat on a fairly constant basis, 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit.
Hot, by the way, 2,700 degrees.
Well, when you get up to that high, this ruminant material actually, it burns. It has a high carbon value, and it's used as fuel. And it reduces the consumption of fossil fuels on the one hand. Mm-hmm. It takes care of getting rid of these things. And basically the risk of disease, they say it's, hold on a second, the cement kilns destroy organic constituencies with an efficacy of 99.9999%. So, I mean, this makes a lot of sense. That may start to happen in the United States. And if we can find another use for this waste, then I think that we have a chance of not feeding The Department of Agriculture calls it the firewall feed ban.
Well, it's such a good idea, because what are we doing here? We're creating all this waste, and this is a huge problem for cattle farmers. They've got to get rid of their waste. Well, what we don't want them to do is to feed it to somebody, is to feed it back to it's waste, okay? Don't feed it back to a cow. Don't feed it to a chicken. Don't even feed it to a duck, okay? It's waste material, and they've come up with this.
Are
really
you my mother?
Idea.
I'm sorry. We went on the whole animal farm, and I...
But it's waste material, and finding uses for this waste material is something that we in this country must efficiently do, because you don't want to just dispose of it and fill landfills with it or I'm not just talking about this particular waste material. We need to find alternate uses for our waste materials, especially for things that we're using in this quantity. There's a lot of people in this country, and when we don't efficiently use our waste, then we create bigger problems than we had to begin with.
And look, the cost of disposing of waste has to be figured into the cost mm-hmm. of a steak. And if it costs more to get rid of that product than the farmer has to charge, and everyone has to do it, and you have to charge an extra 50 cents a pound for your beef, then you have to charge an extra 50 cents a pound for your beef. But what I alluded to earlier was the Department of Agriculture has in place what they call the firewall feed ban. Mm-hmm. It's a firewall, except the firewall... It's not very good at keeping fire out, because it doesn't allow the direct feeding of cow parts, which used to be powdered and then put into cattle feed. That's the firewall feed ban stops. But what it doesn't stop is we still allow cattle blood to be mm-hmm. turned into the protein base of milk replacer. Now that's given to calves.
To give them to calves. It's not given to people. It's given to calves.
And, anyway, that's just got to stop. That's all I got.
That's not all I
have.
Cut
it out.
Because what have we done here in this European market has forced their government to come up with a solution here. And this isn't just, we're not no longer just talking about disposing of the cattle renderings. We're talking about putting them to use where other fuels were being used and actually doing something good with it. And I think that's the type of solutions that we need to find here. And that's what they need to be. They need to be solutions. They can't, you can't just sweep it under the rug or into the landfill or however you choose to get rid of these things.
And you know what I think is interesting?
Did you like that, under the rug or into the landfill?
No. No, I think the other thing that's interesting is if you live by one of these cattle plants, one of the cement plants, it smells like a barbecue all the time now.
Does it really?
I have no idea.
Because one of the things I was thinking as a negative to this, and I have no idea, so this is just me talking off the top of my head, I bet it smells really bad around these cattle rendering.
Maybe it smells like a barbecue.
At 2,700 degrees, it smells like a Barbara Byrne.
You know what? I knew her. I have to say that I live in Jersey City, New Jersey, and I drive home late at night. And you can't tell me, talk about things mm-hmm. that smell bad. You know, there's all sorts of weird smells that you smell driving over the North Bay Extension at 1 o'clock in the morning.
That you only smell at night.
Yeah. And there are lots of chemical plants. I'm like, what are they releasing into the air at 1 o'clock in the morning that they don't release into the air at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when the mm-hmm. EPA might be around? That's just my little thought for the day. Welcome to Jersey, everyone.
Boy, this show is going to lighten up a lot, I promise. I promise the next 50 minutes of this show are going to be much nicer.
We're going to talk about fun stuff with Anthony Gillier. We're going to talk about cocktails. We're going to talk about restaurants. And some restaurants that we both visited recently in New York. And we also want to talk about Frank Bruni's article. Frank Bruni, the restaurant critic for the New York Times, recently took a job as a waiter for a couple of days, for a week, I think, mm-hmm. and wrote about it in the Times. And I think he has a newfound appreciation for the people who are for the people in which in for in who in which he's sitting in judgment. Did I say that right? I don't think so. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis from Stage Left and Captain Party Restaurant. Our guest today is our favorite food writer of all times, Anthony Gillier. Is Mr. Boston? Actually, he's just edited the most recent Mr. Boston magazine and made it an invaluable bar aide. He's a wine columnist for Boston Magazine. His book is Cocktails in New York, and his freelance articles appear in publications like Food and Wine and other great food publications all the time. He spent a decade reviewing restaurants for New Jersey Monthly, New Jersey Life, the New York Sun, and he joins us today to talk about, well, restaurants. Hey there, Anthony.
Tony Gillier, how are you?
Good, how's it going?
Great.
Good, man. Did you see, and I thought of you when I read this article, did you see the Frank Bruni article in the New York Times? Frank Bruni is the restaurant critic in the New York Times, and he did an article on that where he went out to Connecticut and worked as a waiter. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was a great article.
What were your thoughts as a critic and a food writer about taking a step on the other side?
I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, I had mixed feelings about it. I mean, I found it hard to believe that people didn't know who he was, but then again, you know, if you leave the New York area, where, you know, New York, where every single waiter in history has his picture in their black, you know, checkbook mm-hmm. pad,
right?
But I thought it was an intriguing idea.
I think he might have gone far enough away to get away with it. I truly do. I think he might have been far enough away.
Do you, as a critic, now you worked in the restaurant business a long time ago, right?
Uh-huh.
You care to share with us how long ago?
Not a long time ago, but a long time, too.
You're right.
12 years.
Well, do you think that, I mean, restaurant critics and people who write about food who've never worked in a restaurant sort of lack a certain perspective that maybe you have, and I think that's what Frank Bruni was writing about?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
What do your colleagues not see? Your colleagues who haven't worked in a restaurant, what do they not see, you think, that you sort of get?
Oh, God, the whole chaos of the kitchen behind mm-hmm. the scenes. It's unbelievable. In most restaurants, except the ones that, you know, have the open kitchens, it's as if there's a soundproof wall between, you know, the elegance of the dining room, if they've accomplished that, and the utter chaos in the kitchen.
Yeah, I think people are amazed when they stand in the hallway outside the kitchen of Stage Left or Kathleen Lombardi. And Kathleen Lombardi, actually, we have a greater separation, but they stand in a hallway outside of Stage Left, and we have little window boxes into the kitchen, and people will stand there, and I think they'll be in utter amazement at the speed of which things are happening, at the jargon that's going back and forth among the people who work in the kitchen.
As they stand in the room with the classical guitar music playing in the waiter's suavely
exactly.
Traveling down.
So here's a question for you, Anthony. Bruni clearly is a writer first and tried his foray into the waiting world and into the restaurant world. And Francis and I are clearly restaurant people first, and now we're doing this foray into the radio world. What do you consider yourself first?
A writer first. I was always a writer.
Well, how did you wind up writing about food? Because you write almost exclusively about food, right? And food and cocktails and wine and stuff like that.
I was a writer in writing for National Real Estate Investor just out of college.
Sounds exciting as hell, Andy.
Exactly. And I was blessed to have an editor who said to me, you know what, this really isn't for you. Why don't you study to be a sommelier. I mean, why don't you learn about wine? Women love it. It's a great way to meet people.
Women love it.
She was a very hip editor. I worked for this woman, Dora Hatress. We were great friends, and she was my editor at National Real Estate Investor, and she said, listen, you need to get out of here, and you need to do something fun. You're only 24. Go find a new career. And she let me study during, like, I took Tuesday afternoons off to go study with Roger DeGorn at the Sommelier Society. I took lessons to get a diploma. Uh-huh. I learned wine first, and once I had my palate figured out, everything fell in place.
Now, where did you work in the business?
In restaurants?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I worked at Windows in the World for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at the wine school. And then for waitering, I was actually the opening bar manager at Amanda's in Hoboken, and I slung margaritas for almost 8 years at a margarita bar in Hoboken called East L.A.
Oh, my God, I've been there.
Margaritas.
Yeah, so, margaritas.
But, so there I was a bartender and a waiter at Amanda's. I just did the bar.
Well, and so now you're a full-time professional food writer. That's like a dream that a lot of people have. How do you go about getting things published and getting hired to do all this cool stuff?
It took a very long time. You know, like it's the old, you know, conundrum of, you know, needing experience to get published mm-hmm. but not be getting published without experience. So.
Right.
I wrote for free for a lot of people. I wrote for pennies for a lot of people back in, you know, 15 years ago when I got started.
Right.
And it just was a lot of sucking up. I mean, that's what you have to keep doing, sucking it up.
So what do you think would happen if you spent a week as a waiter now?
I would have fun. I mean,
That's my question. Would you love it, or would you say, oh, my goodness, thank goodness I got away from this?
If I knew that there was an end to the meat, it would be fun.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to go back to that life anymore. But mm-hmm. it certainly was. There was probably some of the best years of my life.
What did you like about it?
I loved the teamwork. Here's my confession. I was never a good athlete. So for me, this was really the first time I ever was a part of a team where we were really dependent upon each other, and there was a lot of camaraderie. And for me, there was something really, I don't know, fulfilling about being a part of this team and us all working together to, you know, to make it from the beginning of the night to the end of the night. And then afterwards, we'd all go out and unwind and have drinks. And it was a great social life as well as a work life. It was the best of both worlds.
Yeah, there's definitely a rush that you get from that kind of a lifestyle.
Yeah. When you when we come back, we're going to be talking with you about the Mr. Boston Guide. I understand you're working on a professional edition of Mr. Boston. And for those who don't know, the Mr. Boston Guide was a terrible book for a long time with a lot of outdated recipes. And, Anthony, you just redid the whole thing. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the imminent professional edition of the Mr. Boston Guide to Cocktails. Our guest is Anthony Giglio, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125. You know, Mark and I are always saying that long-term, good environmental policy and good economic policy are one and the same. And that's not just for the government, it's also for small business and homeowners just like you. To help us put our money where our mouth is, we called E2ECTA. E2ECTA uses a team of specialists to find practical ways for your business or home to conserve energy and even to generate green energy that the utility company then has to buy back from you. That generates a different kind of green for your bottom line. We've gone solar at our restaurants. We're now producing cheap, non-polluting electricity, and with the help of E2ECTA, we did it for very little money. The government programs available to get you set up are unbelievable. We're talking about grants here, not loans, but grants. E2ECTA will help you find the right programs for you, and they'll do the paperwork. You keep the profits. It's a no-brainer, people. For lower energy usage, more profits for yourself, call E2ECTA at 908-359-9300 or click on their link at restaurantguysradio.com. E2ECTA for total energy solutions. Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick. And our guest today is Anthony Giglio. Anthony is our favorite writer about food, wine, and cocktails. His book is Cocktails in New York, and you can find out how to read Anthony Giglio's stuff and get that great book by signing onto our website at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll link you to anthonygiglio.com. Now, you came out with Mr. Boston, and now there's a professional edition of Mr. Boston coming out. What makes one
professional, one non-professional?
If you ask professionals how they use the book, they'll you know, most of them who I went, this is how I've made this proposal. They'll say, you know what, but it's impossible to keep the thing open on the bar.
Yep.
That tight little red book is perfect for like stuffing into drawers and keeping it in the glove compartment or wherever you want to, you know, make your drinks. But to put on the bar,
I never make drinks in the glove compartment, man.
You don't have to admit that anymore. You don't have to admit it. But you really have to break the binding, then you have to snap it to make it stay open, unless you have some gizmo. And I said to my editors, I said, why don't we make a wire-bound edition with a hard cover that will look, as, you know, it'll look perfect from the outside, but it'll function as a workbook when you open it.
Mm-hmm. So now, are you getting a lot of feedback now? The Mr. Boston Guide, as you've done it, it's an invaluable guide, and it was a book that was behind every bar for so long, but useless for so long.
And now back behind our bar.
Are you getting Yeah, it is behind our bar, actually. Are you getting feedback from professional bartenders across America that it's being used?
Unfortunately, you guys are my biggest fans. you know, and it's a function of the deal that I had to make with them. Mr. Boston's been around for 70 years. I'm the editor of the book. There's no Anthony Giglio behind the book. And let's put this on the table. I never talk about myself in the third person. That just was to make an example.
Right.
But, meaning that so they can't contact me. My name can't go in there with an email or, to contact the author, call Wiley Publishing. They're not going to do that. It's not the way it works.
Well, that's unfortunate because I mean that would promote the book so much better.
I think that you're battling 70, well not 70 years, but you're battling 20 years of the book being so bad,
right.
And people just stopped using it, even though it's still behind every bar that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Everybody's still got a copy of it. It's just one of those books that fell into disfavor and now is a useful book again.
Yeah, I think if someone had it in their hand and recognize that there's a new editor there. The look is certainly different, and the color's the same, but the look of the cover has a cocktail glass on it. We brought that back from one of the older versions. But if you would see that on the title page and then Google me, that might be a way to find me because you'll go to my website. But otherwise, nobody's really giving me feedback except the bartenders who were involved.
Mm-hmm.
There were a good many of them. I mean, I think if there were 36 listed on that page, probably I've heard from a good dozen and a half already.
Our guest is Anthony Giglio. He has just edited the new Mr. Boston Guide. They're coming out with a professional edition. That's kind of an interesting book. We're going to talk about that and restaurants and reviewing restaurants more in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon or reach through restaurantguysradio.com. Now you can download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Anthony Giglio. He's our favorite writer about food and wine in the whole wide world. He is the wine columnist for Boston Magazine. He's also recently re-edited the Mr. Boston Guide to Cocktails, which was, before he got to it, a useless book and now a really great book on cocktails. He's a freelance writer. His articles have appeared in Food and Wine. He has reviewed restaurants for the New York Sun, New Jersey Monthly, New Jersey Life. And he joins us today to talk about restaurants. And I want to bring up there's an article, your article that's in Boston Magazine for February. You talk about French wine, and you talk about how there's a new sea of affordable French wine out there. What's that due to?
Yeah, what happened there?
Because you're driving it.
I am not. I only drink expensive wine.
You're soaking in it. We're driving French wine around. Last year, for the first time in history, the French government permitted French winemakers to make ethanol out of AOC wines.
Wow, and AOC wines are the top French wines.
Yeah, so you know, millions of gallons of wine that were otherwise selling at supermarkets for less than the price of water.
Wow.
Were now going into ethanol, which is, I didn't even know this, that America is one of the top importers of French ethanol for gasoline.
So we are importing it after all, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
We're bringing their wine in after
all.
That's
okay. Again, it all comes back to fuel. It's okay if we do that. We just don't want, you know, we're just supposed to not take their food or wine.
So,
you know what I mean?
Anthony, I want you to know that that's really how I got most of my bad habits.
Where?
The summer I lived in France. Okay. Beer and wine were cheaper than water and soda.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I love Europe.
Yeah.
So what's driven it? Is it this? How big a role does the American boycott of French products play, or has it played?
Statistically, they're not willing to talk about it. I mean, I did speak to the Food and Wines from France, which is the French government's gastronomic arm here in New York and for America, and they tried to put a positive spin, just saying that last year was the first year that we've rebounded. You know, statistically, things take forever to catch up anyway. But they had been on a downward slump for 3 years, at least 3 years, if not, they say, you know, you could plot it for a decade and see that they had just been declining, declining, declining. But both pre-war rhetoric, it had a lot to do with the prices just getting progressively higher and higher and higher, just like you could say the same about California. The problem is that a lot of the bargain stuff wasn't being imported because of the cost of bringing in inexpensive stuff for what they'd gained for it. So now the bargains are coming back in.
And that's the result of some the Gallo family working with some French wine exporters?
Yeah, that's what opens the gate. It's like when all the big winemakers move to a region that's been, you know, unheralded for a while, and everyone starts, it causes a real estate rush. The Gallos went down to the Languedoc region and founded French Bicyclette, very playful labels of a guy on a bike mm-hmm. with a beret and a little dog with a baguette in its mouth is chasing him, and it's completely harmless. I don't think people even realize it's a French wine until if they bother to read the small print on the label, because it's varietally named Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Syrah, Merlot. They reversed the trend single-handedly by selling over almost 2 million bottles.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
In the first year.
And we should tell everybody that the Languedoc is a region in southern France where a lot of the country wines are coming from, a lot of the less expensive, kind of more basic wines from France.
I got to tell you a funny story. I mean, I don't know how much of this is related to the whole Freedom Fries, we don't want French stuff. I see that has really declined. People are not as vehement about not wanting French stuff. And you know, we had a few people in the restaurant that would not want French wines back when this whole thing started. But there were usually people that weren't drinking French wines beforehand anyway, so I don't think there was
a... It made me feel good to say it.
Well, it wasn't a huge shift, I found, but I did have... When this whole thing started, we have a bunch of cheeses on the board at Stage Left. And the one thing that was easy to sort of forego was French cheese. And I remember I was working on the table. I was working as a maitre d' in Stage Left, and I had like pounds and pounds of French cheese that I wasn't going to throw away, you know? And we did go to All-American Cheeses for a while. So I rolled over the cheese cart to a table. It was a very, very busy night, and I had instructed the waiters to stop saying France when describing where the cheeses were coming from. Like, there are a bunch of different cheeses on the board. Like, we would usually say, you know, this is a cow's milk cheese from France and it's aged, whatever. So we just said, this is a cow's milk cheese and it's aged for 30 days, you know. So I walked over and
it's called Pavé Daffinois.
we just call it Pavé. I went through all the cheeses and I got to this wine from the Basque country in the Pyrenees, and it was Petit Basque, and I was specifically leaving out the countries, and I got one joker who knows geography right at the table of five guys, and I came to the Petit Basque, and I said, no, this is a wine, it's from it's a Basque cheese, it's from the Basque country, and he said, the French Basque country or the Spanish Basque country?
Busted.
I was like, yeah.
Yes, one of those.
The Basques hate the French more than we do. I mean, you know, what are the cheese? All right, so you have been reviewing restaurants for 10 years, and you've been reviewing, while you've reviewed in New York, you've also reviewed outside of New York, in New Jersey. Do you think... And, you know, Mark and I, when we started 15 years ago, we used to say, you know, Jersey is just, it's, you can look at the trends in New York, and Jersey's 7 years behind, so you wait for a year or two and see which ones are still existing in New York, and you just, you're 5 years behind New York, and you're fine. And you're on the cutting edge of New Jersey. It strikes me, do you think that was a valid assessment of 15 years ago in the restaurant business in Jersey?
15 years ago? Yeah.
And do you think that that's catching up? I think that margin is getting smaller. Do you?
Yeah. There are restaurant, but there are restaurant hotbeds in this state that have everything to do with geography that would always get me into trouble. Like, I think that if I were, you know, would I, you know, if I were king, there would be Hoboken magazine. there would be somewhere out in Horse Country magazine, and maybe Morristown magazine. Bergen County gets its own, and then the whole shore is just, you know, that could be divided into three places too, but. There's a lot of the state that's, you know, that's quaint and countrified and still somewhat backwards, or strip mall city. I mean, there's just strip malls everywhere.
What are the towns that you think are hotbeds for restaurants in New Jersey?
Red Bank, Hoboken, Ridgewood. Long Beach Island is interesting because you have several high quality restaurants that are only open a few months a year.
Mm-hmm.
And Atlantic City, I mean, Atlantic City gets, you know, pilloried all the time, but if you really went down there and just avoided all of the casinos and, you know, went in the back door or whatever, you know, however you can get to the places without having to go through the chaos, there are probably a good, I'd say, dozen restaurants down there that are worth the ride.
Mm-hmm.
Cape May is interesting, too, and, you know, scenic as well. And then around Cherry Hill, which really, like, you know, I just read a piece about Cherry Hill in the Times 2 weeks ago about it. Finally, you know, they're trying to make a center of town for them. Like, it's really just a big suburban sprawl.
What's in Cherry Hill restaurant-wise?
Restaurant-wise, I'll tell you that the best sushi place in the state is just outside of Cherry Hill called Sagami.
Really?
Best sushi in the state. It's like 5 minutes from Philadelphia.
Now, I want you to give an honest answer, and this, I'm not pressuring you at all, but you did leave out New Brunswick. Do you think that New Brunswick as...
Oh, my God, I'm so nervous.
It's okay, I'm going to edit this out.
We don't talk about this. We should talk ahead of time, and I can prepare.
No. I'm really curious, and I'm not...
But you're the only game in town there, so why would I call that a hot restaurant town?
I love you.
Come on.
I'm serious. Do you think that that's a hot restaurant town or overall because of all the restaurants there, or do you think that...
Yeah, well, you know what it is? I think New Brunswick has a lot in common with Hoboken in that youth brings energy and dynamism to your restaurant scene. Maybe they're not all fine dining, but there's a lot happening there.
Yeah. A lot of interesting places.
Yeah.
I have a much harder question for you.
Uh-oh.
What towns in New Jersey do you think have an overrated restaurant scene?
Wow, yeah.
Huh.
I told you it was going to be harder. I wasn't kidding. I meant it
Hoboken
was going to be harder.
I could say only because, of course, I live close to it, mm-hmm. and I get to inspect it on a lot more casual basis than I do, you know, riding across the state. Hoboken is stereotypically an old Italian community. You know, first it was German, then it was Italian. But, you know, you could ask people there, where's a good Italian restaurant, and they couldn't name two.
All right, let me throw out, well, Princeton. Give me a view of Princeton.
That's a great thing. All the times I was sent there, I don't think I was ever impressed in Princeton once.
Yeah, I think they're kind of overrated. That
might be one.
They all come to New Brunswick for dinner. Hey, Anthony, thanks for taking the time to be on the show with us.
Thank you, guys.
It's been super. That's Anthony Giglio. He's the editor of the new Mr. Boston Guide to Cocktails, and he's also the wine columnist for Boston Magazine. His book is Cocktails in New York. You can find out more about it. It's a fabulous book, and you can link to it from our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, you're back at the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis, this is Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. And we said goodbye to Anthony Giglio at the end of the last segment, but he just didn't go away. At the commercial.
Every time I try and pull out, they pull me back in.
I keep looking at my monitor, keep saying, Anthony Giglio, line two. Anthony Giglio, line two.
Actually, during the commercial break, we wound up talking about a restaurant that we talked about earlier. We had, and it turns out we both, on almost consecutive nights, had gone to Mario Batali, Joe and Lydia Bastianich's new restaurant called Del Posto in New York. And Del Posto is their bid, I think, for a four-star, to be the first four-star Italian restaurant by the New York Times. Would you agree with that assessment of what it is that you think they're going for?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's by far the most European restaurant in New York.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of the restaurant overall? Did you love it?
Yeah, we talked about it last week, but I'd love to hear what you have.
I'm biased. I mean, I happen to be a big fan of all the restaurants, and if I were to say... Do I get what they're going for? Absolutely.
But isn't everybody in New York and New Jersey now biased towards Mario and Joe and Lydia's restaurants? I mean, they to my mind are probably the top restaurant owners in all of New York.
Absolutely, I think so too. I would agree.
But do you think they've achieved or they're on a track to achieve what it is they're going for?
Yeah, they're on track. The place is brand new.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to I imagine that even with staff, it's such a brain drain on their other restaurants. They mm-hmm. couldn't, bring everyone over. So I imagine the newer people who were there, who were new to the fold, so this is a complete departure from anything they've done.
Mm-hmm. Now you walk into this gorgeous room, and it's got this brilliant white marble staircase in the center of the room leading up. And we got an 8:30 reservation, and we sat at one of those private tables up, like looking over the rest
right
of the restaurant.
Right up on a balcony, like almost as if we were looking at a theater below us.
What was your experience like when you went there?
I actually sat on ground level at the bar, and there was a brilliant old barman there who was a seasoned gent. He was he made a magnificent Manhattan. The glassware is beautiful.
The glassware is spectacular.
He just did it, and he took his time. It wasn't crazy. I did get the blue plate hour. I got a 5:45. And I'll tell you, after 4 hours of dining, I was happy I got the 5:45. I was still home in bed at 10:30.
We got the 8:30. We were there till 1.
Yeah, there's not a lot of name dropping here, by the way, going on yet. Right now it's like every man for himself.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, Alan Richmond was seated 5 minutes after me, which made me feel really good. I thought I was a nobody, and I thought, oh, there's Alan Richmond.
So who else did you spot in the dining room when you were there?
So Alan Richmond was sitting right in front of me, with his back to me. With 3 bottles of wine on the table, by the way. One of them was carafed. I couldn't get close enough to see what he had, though.
Uh-huh.
And he was always one other person, and not his wife, Letty Teague, who's the wine editor at Food and Wine. Next to us was Adam Platt from New York Magazine, and he was with a party of four.
Walked in and sat down, too.
Serious. I'm sorry?
And he just walked in right after you guys sat down as well?
Yeah, we all sat at the 6 o'clock reservation.
Oh, my God.
And then you had brunch.
Right. So he has brunch. And then at 8 o'clock, in walks Jay McInerney with a party of 8.
Oh, my God.
And that was about the latest table that I stayed till after 10, and nobody came in after him. I mean, it was, they kept, I think they're keeping it
very, very close, you know, close at hand right now.
Well, yeah, but if you look at that dining room at the moment, you've got three food writers and Jay McInerney, the novelist, who also writes about food and wine. That's right. Like a press machine there.
I came unannounced with the food editor from Travel and Leisure, Neela Muhammad, and her husband Peter Dunlinberg, who's a columnist for Travel and Leisure.
God Almighty.
So it was a powerhouse, and they were just dancing around table to table.
You know what's you know what's interesting is when we were there, we also we happened to go with other friends in the wine business, and also a couple of chefs we had visiting from out of town who we interviewed on this show, and there's a lot of foodies there, man.
Yeah, well, everyone wants to see what they're doing. I mean, they're trying to do something completely different. They're not competing here for against the four star French. They're trying to make something that's unheard of here.
Trying to make something completely new, which I even if they don't 100% succeed, and they're still, I don't think it's perfect yet, but I think that they're really blazing new trails.
Now, we've only got a couple of minutes, but you said two things that I would really like to hear you expound on for readers. One is that it's not French at all in style. It's the first Italian restaurant, and it's a real Italian sensibility to a restaurant, and it's the most European restaurant in New York City right now. What do you mean by those two things? What are they doing so differently?
Well, I mean, okay, let me clarify. When I say most European, it's the most formally European.
Okay.
I mean, the place is just, you know, dripping in marble. It feels grown up and formal when you walk in. Everything echoes. I mean, it's got a pianist, a live pianist playing. When throughout the meal, we just kept like listening and saying like, you know, we're waiting for the theme from Casablanca.
right.
There's more waiters than they know what to do with.
Right.
You know what I mean? We probably had five waiters to our table of four.
Yeah, that's one of the things.
Plus the sommelier and the sommelier's assistant. Mm-hmm. It was just, everyone seems to have backup. It's like I said, that cost them a fortune.
The other thing that I found that cost them a fortune was real estate. There was a lot of room between tables.
Yeah.
There was a lot of privacy, which in New York City is really hard to come by, even at the nicest places.
Yeah. Well, you have to be able to get those enormous Gueridons through with the Bolito Misto and everything else.
I have to say the wines were fabulous. What were your thoughts of the food? Where are they in food? Do you think they have some work to do yet, or you think they're right on?
I have to say everything was delicious, and we ate a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I was trying to say, like, what would my friends do if they were here? What would my parents do if they were here? The menu is bilingual. You have to read it. And read it until it finally sinks in, like what you're having. There's a lot of choices.
Right.
There's a lot. Like, the menu's kind of daunting in the beginning. And we play with the waitress and say, like, can you tell us about, you know, what you like here and what's been really selling well? And she started gingerly, like, well, this is great and that's great. And then before we knew it, she was reading the entire menu, line for line. Us.
Actually, we're gonna take a quick break. We'll be back with Anthony Giglio talking about Del Posto Restaurant in Manhattan in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest is food and wine writer Anthony Giglio. And we were talking about Del Posto, Mario Batali, Lydia, and Joe Bastianich's new restaurant in New York, where we both dined on separate nights last week. And we were talking about just what makes it different than any other restaurant in New York right now and where we think the food is. Do you think the food's going to change and evolve, or do you think they've pretty much hit where they want to be?
I think that they're where they want to be. I think that it might actually be a case of them thinning out the menu a little bit, seeing what works,
mm-hmm.
Seeing how many people are ordering, you know, for two. When you know, like there was a pork roast for two that's like $60.
Yeah.
The prices, you go knowing that it's going to happen. But even like, for instance, risotto, you have to order for two no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you're spending like, you know, 20-something bucks on a plate of risotto.
Well, just so you know, we were a party of more than four, and we were forced into everyone having a tasting menu.
Yeah, any party larger than four, there are a lot of restrictions on the menu. But you know what? It was brilliant. It was just brilliant,
right.
I thought.
But here's what I mean by when I said European when we spoke earlier. Think about it. We got a 5:45, and we owned that table for the night.
Yeah,
never made it to feel like we actually were like, can we leave? We have a babysitter.
Yeah, no, and that's a very European thing where you would have a table for one seating for an evening,
right.
or maybe two, but you're certainly not rushed out. In most New York restaurants, you have dinner for two. They want that table back in 2 hours.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and they've booked someone else to sit after you in 2 hours. I recommend it highly, and I think even just to go to the bar for now, it's formal, but to me it's very comfortable. The restaurant's Del Posto. It's in Manhattan.
It's beautiful, and it's a great restaurant experience. It's got all the components, I think, of a top restaurant in New York.
All right, Anthony. Thanks for coming to talk with us. Now you have to leave this time because the show's over.
Thanks, guys.
All right, take care, Anthony.
I will be back.
I'm sure. All right, that was Anthony Giglio. Anthony is a great writer. His book is called Cocktails in New York. You can find him at anthonygiglio.com. We always have that link up on our website. He's the wine columnist for Boston Magazine. He's also edited the Mr. Boston Guide to Cocktails, which is really good for a change. It was really kind of allows
really updated and upgraded.
I hope you've enjoyed the last hour talking with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.